This is an ABC podcast.
This is Stories from the Pacific with Bobby McCumber on ABC Radio Australia.
Hello and welcome to Stories from the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia. I'm Bobby McCumber. For centuries, Pacific Islanders have been sharing stories right across the region. And on Stories from the Pacific, we'll be honouring that tradition. Stories from the Pacific draws you deep into the life of someone you may or may not have heard about. A Pacific Islander who has seen and done amazing things. Today, on the first ever show of Stories from the Pacific, Thomas Fornua. When Thomas Fornua was 16, he had a life-changing decision to make. He could either play for the New Zealand men's under-19 rugby team, the first step towards becoming an All Black, or join Black Grace, New Zealand's premier contemporary dance company. His dad warned him against choosing dance over rugby, but he chose not to take his dad's advice and ended up touring the world as a professional dancer. Nowadays, he's better known for his drag queen name, Queen Kong. The Samoan Tongan is the first Pacifica queen to appear on the worldwide hit TV show RuPaul's Drag Race Down Under. Welcome, Thomas.
Hey, how you going?
What did your dad actually say to you when you had to choose between rugby or dancing?
Oh, look, you know, I think most people that know from the Pacific know that, you know, our culture, there's a lot of shame when it comes to anything outside of what we're comfortable with. And so I think my dad was really concerned that people were going to make fun of me or laugh at me. That's what he said. He was like, people are going to laugh at you. And I was like, good, let them laugh.
So let's take it back to before that moment with your dad and let's talk about your childhood. What were you like as a kid?
When I was born, I was always very, just different. I had two older siblings, two older brothers and a younger sister, and I definitely was flamboyant and very just feminine. You know, I think I was definitely the fuffa of our family, and I think that made my dad really uncomfortable for the most part just because he didn't know how I was going to be received. And again, there's that shame thing that we talk about a lot, and I think a lot of unpacking in my adult life has been around trying to, you know, not pass that shame onward. It was a pretty tricky time growing up, especially in South Auckland and in New Zealand. Being queer, knowing that I was queer, but also going to church, playing sports around men that were men, and being kind of, you know, looked at as not equal, but definitely having the same size or probably being two times the size of most of the other boys. So it was tricky and hard to navigate, but yeah, it was definitely a journey that I wouldn't change because it's made me into the person that I am today.
If you'd chosen rugby, how do you think your life would be now?
Oh, look, I think there's definitely versions of that example, like here right now that I can sort of look at. There's definitely a trajectory I could have went on. You know, I could have been Tana Umanga or Jonah Lomu, either of the two definitely look like me when I'm in drag. So I think there's definitely versions of what that would look like. I love sport and I love rugby and I loved training and being a part of a team. So it wasn't too far-fetched, but I knew it wasn't completely for me. I was doing it for my father. So yeah, that was a hard decision, but a decision that I don't regret at all.
Were you always clear in your mind with what you should do?
Not at all. I think I was never sure. I actually think it was the opposite for me. I didn't think I was ever going to find anything. Just because when you are raised in like a place like South Auckland and Mangere, I think the examples was either you go to sports, you play rugby and you train and you do really well, or the other version is you stay in South Auckland and you work in a factory. Mm. That was the kind of only two options. And, you know, unless you dare to dream or dare to think outside the box, you know, especially at that time, which wasn't that long ago, but I was the first generation of Tongan Samoan, you know, in my family to be born in New Zealand in a Western urban environment. So lots of it was trial and error. So I think, yeah, there wasn't much room for me to see anything else. So I didn't think dance or drag was ever going to be a thing for me. In fact, I thought I was going to be in the church and playing rugby for the rest of my life.
Yeah. Right. Who did support you to think outside the box?
Oh, look, I've always been fortunate. And I think the thing about drag and the irony of me coming to drag at this time in my life and making a career out of it is it's definitely a love letter to all of the women in my family who have held me up since I was a baby and just championed me and protected me from just all of the conditioning and all of the stereotypes and all of the the projections that people sort of put onto you, especially within our communities. So, yeah, it's the woman in my family, my mom, my nana, who's the matriarch of our family. She was a big one because she was our elder, and she really just kept me by her side. No one really could say anything.
So sport and church really, I guess, shaped your life growing up. Can you describe to me where you actually grew up?
Yeah, so I grew up in Mangere, which is infamously, I think, when we were growing up, South Auckland had such a harsh rap from the media. Low DSR schooling, low socioeconomic background, very poor our family was, and most of the people in the family are all around our neighbourhood, around the area, were very poor. Lots of the franchises target these places, like McDonald's, KFC, Burger King, they're all like in one strip in South Auckland. So, yeah, it's not really a place where you kind of dare to dream and don't think there's really much opportunity. So we lived in like a little house close to a place called the Mangere Town Centre. And that was like our bubble was literally Mangere Town Centre, Favona Primary School, Nana's house and our house. That was like as far as we kind of went. And then the rugby field and church. So it was quite a small little bubble.
And you also spent a bit of time growing up in Samoa as well?
Yeah, well, we went back and forth between Samoa and Tonga. My dad's Tongan, so I think my dad's goal was to save enough money and work hard enough to move us back to the islands because, in his mind, you know, the islands have such a better way of living in terms of what we learn and what he learned. So he really wanted to pass that on to us. So we went back as much as we could. We didn't get to move there, unfortunately, because of circumstances. But you know, I do frequently go back home and try to stay as connected as I can to the motherland and you know, keep the language alive because I think it's important. And I really do. I think I pay homage a lot to my culture, especially within my drag. I kind of champion my community and make sure that the stories that we share are still being shared and are staying alive.
You know, I remember growing up and corned beef and rice, thinking this was one of the greatest meals on earth that my mum used to make. What are some foods that remind you of your childhood in Samoa and Tonga?
Definitely corned beef. Yeah, definitely corned beef, definitely taro. Those are the pinnacles of, like, you know, that's the on the gongai table, that's like two of the most important dishes. Chop suey for sure. Balsami, yes. You know, everything that can give you diabetes or high blood pressure. So, all those things that give you gout when you're now our age. All of those things that I love to eat.
Well, what types of things do you do now to embrace your Samoan and Tongan heritage? And also growing up, what type of things did you do?
Oh, well, like we were part of, so my family in particular, my mum and my dad, they raised us in the Jehovah's Witness Church, and we went to a Tongan congregation, which were full speaking Tongan. So language has always been a huge part of like my, the way that I keep our culture alive, like making sure that I can speak both languages is really important to me. My nana who was Samoan was just, she taught me everything in terms of performance. Like, and I think my understanding of performance has always been ceremonial because in the islands, you know, it's another rite of passage or another way to keep our ceremonies alive because they have, each movement has a purpose, each word has a purpose. And so there's such an importance that each bit of dance or song sort of bestows on people. And I think when I moved into working for Black Grace Dance Company and also other companies across my career, I think that was something that really set me aside from other dancers, was my awareness of not only performance but the meaning of things and trying to find importance in everything that I do. So in this day and age, I kind of dedicate everything, every look that I do, there's some element that's, you know, connecting me to Samoa or to Tonga. Every time I get an opportunity to speak on a main stage, especially in front of TV, like I make sure that I speak about, you know, my community and the things that are important to me because, there's not much representation in the media and we're getting better, but, you know, I just want to inspire younger Pasifika artists, people, leaders to, you know, speak about where we come from and the beauty of our islands because they really do set us aside from this world.
What are some of the advantages, do you think, of speaking both Samoan and Tongan fluently?
Personally, it's really good because, like, when you're, I think my mom learned, because my mom's full Samoan, my dad's Tongan. My mom learned Tongan discreetly so that she could understand what my nana on my dad's side was saying about her behind her back. So it's definitely, like, handy to know both languages, especially because I think I look Tongan. So when I'm around Samoans, especially if I'm in drag, you know, there's lots of whispers happening. So you can, it's nice to know the language so that you can respond to them when they're being disrespectful. That's definitely a plus side, but I think the other thing that's important too is just just having an awareness, having the ability to, you know, to go home and actually feel like you're connected to land, you know, like as much as you are connected because it's in your blood. I think, you know, language is a huge thing that, you know, can also bring shame and guilt if you don't feel like you, or it could stop you from feeling connected to where you come from. And so, you know, I do as much as I can to try and keep that alive within myself and within our family. Mm. We try to keep that alive too. I've got nieces and nephews who are babies that are coming up, which are my mum's grandchildren now. So we have such a responsibility to make sure that we continue what my nana started and also what her mum and our foremothers and forefathers have done, you know, so it's just important. Mm.
You played sport as a kid, which set you up as an unbelievable rugby player. Who taught you to dance as a kid?
Oh, my nana. Yeah, my nana taught all this thing. She taught my sister how to dance. So my sister started learning how to do the Samoan Siwa and the Taulunga, which is a Tongan version of that as well, quite young. So when she was around 2, 3, they started teaching her. And I always would complain because I wanted to learn how to do the Siwa, but it's traditionally for women. So what I would do is just secretly learn it while my nana was teaching. And she would teach me my version of, like, the four kaimi and everything. But it was my nana who taught us how to do all of that stuff. It was the grace that I was really, really taken by, and also just the beauty of, of the, especially the female dancing in our community. So my nana was the one that taught us how to do all of the things.
You're listening to Stories from the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia. I'm Bobby McCumber, and I'm speaking with Thomas Fonua, also known as Queen Kong. Now, Thomas, you mentioned earlier at the age of 16, you did choose dancing and you toured the world. That must have been hard, moving away from home at 16. Can you tell me some of the biggest challenges you faced?
Oh, yeah. Look, I think, you know, I remember when I first got into Black Race, like I did their youth company, which went across like 3 months, and they trained us. And at the end of the performance period, when we did our big showcase, they offered me a full-time job as like an apprentice for them. And so that was like a 2-year apprentice, which meant that we were going on the road, and I had 2 weeks to learn a 2-hour show that they'd been touring for years, you know. And I think the second youngest after me was, I think, 24, and the eldest was 42. So a 16-year-old walking into that, even though I looked like I was 35 and I had 5 kids because I grew up and built like a brick house, I think mentally and emotionally and spiritually, I wasn't necessarily as mature as any of those other performers in the company. So I think the biggest struggle that I had initially was just fitting in, you know, like the experiences that these people had. And that's just like on a personal level, lived experience. These people have had years of touring and have been working in that company as professionals full time forever. And I hadn't even thought the idea of dancing full time was a job. So I was just thrown into the deep end. And I think I always work better by being thrown in the deep end because I work really well under pressure. But I definitely think the hardest part was fitting in. And then also, and my first tour was 2 weeks after joining the company, and we went to Germany. And previously before then, I'd never left home. Like, and I'd never been, the furthest I've been was to Samoa or to Tonga. And they never felt like glamorous trips because as soon as we got off the plane, it was like barefoot, doing all the chores, you know, chasing after pigs. Like, you know what I mean? None of it was a glamorous, like, resort. Everyone that goes out to Samoa to stay in a resort is a lie. Because if you're from Samoa, you don't live in a resort, you live in a shack with open, like, with no windows, no doors, which we love. It's humbling. You go there for grounding, you don't go there for a vacation. But yeah, we went to Germany, and I remember not really processing that I was going away from my mum until she was driving me to the airport. And I remember having this massive meltdown in the car, just freaking out because I knew that I was going away from her. And I remember every night, I think for the first 2 years, because we were touring like 7-8 months of the year outside of the country, I was on the phone every night to my mum, crying, wanting to come home because it was hard. So, you know, I think it was definitely like a an adjustment for me. I think things that I was doing was definitely what I wanted to do, but yeah, it was just a lot of just fake it till you make it.
You were a 16-year-old earning money, living a relatively glamorous life. Did it feel like that?
The pay wasn't glamorous, I'll say that. Okay. So I was working really, really hard, touring around the world and not necessarily receiving much to sort of show for my time. But the experience that I got and being able to work like the way that I worked really set the tone for how I was going to go out into the world after Black Grace and just win and do really, really well. But yeah, so touring and stuff was really, really, really fun, really hard. But majority of the time you're doing two shows a day with one day break here and there. And you, like across a 7-week tour, you probably get three days off and you're performing, yeah, really, really crazy in different towns on a bus, traveling, performing, traveling, performing, traveling, performing, coming home and burning out. So it was definitely an experience and I think something that I could do when I was younger. But now I'm a drag queen because I don't want to do that anymore. It's too hard.
So what did happen after you left Black Grace? Tell us about that decision to leave.
So, as an artist, I think most artists always get to a point in any place that they are where they kind of need to leave a place and go out and continue to grow. And I think by the time I hit 20, 21, I was kind of at that place. I'd spent about 4 years with Black Grace, just going on up to five years. And I felt like I was ready to go out into the world and see what else was next. And as much as I wanted to stay in New Zealand, the reality is outside of Black Grace at the time, that was the only full-time dance company and the most elite. So I came over to Australia and had auditioned for a bunch of companies and I got scouted by the Australian Dance Theatre, which is where I ended up working for about 7 years as a principal dancer and just really made my mark as a contemporary artist as well as a choreographer.
So you're currently known as a drag queen, Queen Kong, obviously. Can you describe the segue from your more conventional dancing to drag?
Yeah, for sure. I think naturally I've always been, as I said, like the Fafa, I've got that spirit within me that is definitely like Fafa energy. And I think for me, there's always been a curiosity around gender and also how that trickles into the performance space. And working in Australian Dance Theatre, I was working under a director called Gary Stewart, who really just for myself, I just appreciated his mentorship. He was always very he would always embrace me depending on what shape or form I would offer. And I think the work that he would make and when I was in the company was super genderless. And so whatever we wanted to do on stage or however we wanted to, whatever we would offer in the creative development, he would just really pick up and just let us be how we wanted to be. And there was a couple of drag shows and like variety shows that was around Adelaide at the time. And me and one of my best friends who was in the company decided to enroll in the Halloween one, which was kind of good because we looked like a bloody massacre in the first night in drag. I thought I looked like Beyonce, but I looked like Beyonce's dad, like who had been hit by a truck and been decomposing for about 5 years. So, needless to say, no one's going to ever find photos of that night ever again because they've been burnt to the crisp. I'll be cancelled. I naturally, like in my investigation, like within the studio, within the contemporary framework, I just started like dabbling in just performance outside of contemporary work and just a bit more like fun stuff that was fun and entertaining to myself. So I caught an itch and I did a variety show which was a Halloween show and just became a hit, and Queen Kong, the name Queen Kong, which comes from the rugby field, was born, and then became from the side hustle she became the main hustle because people just wanted to see her lots.
How did the name come from rugby, Queen Kong?
So when I was playing rugby, people would call me Queen Kong because I was definitely very effeminate and also just like a bulldozer on the rugby field. Like no one could stand next to me and I would love it. I would just plow through every single person that was on the field. So they would call me Queen and Kong because I was like a female gorilla.
You obviously enjoy making people laugh. You're very good at it. Do you remember the first time that you made someone laugh?
Oh, I think naturally, humour in our communities, especially in Samoa and Tonga, like people, we love to laugh. And I think the tricky thing about our humour, though, is sometimes it's tricky because it's like a dark humour that it's jokes within the family, it's jokes that hurt. You know what I mean? Like when they read you, like they'll say something really insulting and then laugh. And you feel like you laugh and then you go home and cry because you're like, oh my God, that was really hurtful. You called me a man and I'm trying to look like a woman. woman. How dare you? So yeah, I don't know. Like I've always liked enjoyed making people laugh because I think, you know, naturally it's something that we can share. And especially when you go through trauma, the best thing you can do is laugh rather than cry.
This is Stories from the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia.
What do your family think of Queen Kong?
It's divided, but I think it was divided up until Drag Race, until I became successful and started making really good money. And now everyone that was like an asshole to me now loves me. So I think, you know, my mom, the ones that have been for me since the beginning have definitely been the women in the family that have always like embraced the fact that I was just like a idiot and a clown and loved to like throw myself around to Beyonce. And, you know, I was just always really flamboyant and would make my nana laugh. And I think, naturally the woman would always protect me. And so, yeah, they love Queen Kong and seeing her on the main stage of, you know, RuPaul's Drag Race and now the ambassador of every bloody festival and brand in Australia at the moment has been really sort of eye-opening and just, I think they're just really proud. Yeah.
Now, Queen Kong appeared in RuPaul's Drag Race Down Under season 2 last year. Tell me how this came about.
Mm-hmm. When Drag Race called and asked if I'd be interested in jumping on the second season, I had to jump at the opportunity and also take the opportunity to really represent not only my culture, but to speak for the communities that are really looked over within our queer community. You know, it's the minorities within the minority group that don't get the same opportunities, that aren't paid the same, that aren't, you know, even really seen as equal yet in Australia. So that was the biggest reason why I wanted to go on. I didn't really give a shit about a crown. Sorry for that. I didn't really give a damn about a crown. Because my name is Queen, and so it comes with the name. The title comes with the name. So I really just wanted to go on there and represent and also to empower the communities that I represent, you know, to feel capable and valid and valued so that they can come on and continue to, you know, fight to be on the show and to be visible and to represent the communities, because we are very diverse in Australia. But I want to see more diversity championed, not only as artists, but the people behind the camera making the big decisions and making the power decisions. So that was my biggest intention.
Do you think you've been successful in that?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I think, you know, coming to the US, like, I think I definitely made my mark and made our mark. And I think, you know, there's definitely been conversations that, you know, have happened. But aside from conversations, actions have been made. And I think, obviously, it's so easy to speak about things, but you know, the proof's in the pudding, and I always operate on the premises that, you know, my actions speak louder than my words. And I think since the season's aired, I have seen a real rise in the community for, you know, more representation, more spaces for POC and Black and Indigenous artists in clubs, let alone, you know, in corporations and in queer organizations, you know, sitting in boards, you know, being able to speak at the table and have a chair at the table rather than the chair by the toilet where they can't hear anything happening in the middle of the table. So, It's been a journey, but I think, you know, slowly we're getting there. And I think naturally it's all the discomfort around the conversation is starting to simmer, and we're starting to see more of a collective response to this issue that is definitely an issue. Yeah.
Yeah. What would you say has been your proudest moment in life so far?
Oh, that's a good question. You know, I think the proudest moment for myself, I think personally, my proudest moment, I think it's been recently, actually. Like, I think, you know, aside from everything that I've achieved and everything that I've done, I think I've always been attached to this feeling of, the guilt and shame. And I think in the past year, I've had this enormous amount of growth where I've just, since RuPaul's Drag Race, I've just let it be, and I've sort of let go of any kind of issue that my family or the family that has issues with me might have. I've let all of that kind of stuff go. And I think that within the community, there's a lot of us that have versions of worrying about things that we have no control over and feeling unworthy because we feel like what we are is wrong. And I think my proudest moment recently has been not feeling any of that within my being at all. Walking down the road in drag, being here in LA and being at DragCon and seeing not only Pacific people, but just seeing people recognize me for what I am, but more than my drag, recognizing me for the work that I've done and the vulnerability that I showed on the show. Those are things that I was really proud of, you know, because money comes and goes and accolades come and go. But I think all of it's about unpacking and trying to find the best way to be the best version of myself as possible. And I feel like I'm getting there. So I'm pretty proud of that.
You talk a lot about your grandmother and how much she's been a matriarch in your family. What do you think she would think of Queen Kong?
Oh, I think my nana would love it. I think she'd be really proud of me. Yeah, and I think she would say that I look like my father. Yeah. So I think she would love it. And I also know that my nana was, yeah, she's definitely here with me. And I think the resilience that I have and the strength that I have, I attribute to her because I know she's still around me. My nana's name was Alofa. And Alofa in Samoa is the word for love. And she was that, like, through and through, like, in all facets, like, unconditional love, but she was tough love. Like, that woman was tough. So I know she would love what I am and who I am and what I do. And, yeah, I probably would be taking her to all of my gigs and to all of the meet and greets and, you know, putting on a throne and just treating her like the queen that she is. Because, yeah, I think Queen Kong is definitely cut from the same cloth as Alofa.
Do you think Alofa watching you on RuPaul, would she believe her eyes or?
I think she would believe her eyes, but she would be really annoyed at me that I didn't win. she would be embarrassed that I didn't win. And she was that nana. Like if she came to the premiere party and she saw me lose, she would be the one that get escorted out because she'd be like cussing everyone out and saying that it was rigged and that I was robbed, which I think is true. No, just kidding.
What is next for Queen Kong?
Oh, there's a lot coming up. Yeah, like I am such a workhorse through and through, but I think some of the things that I can speak about. So I'm currently in the US, but I'm working on some music actually that's going to be coming out later in the year. Aside from that, I've got a show called Club Kong that is basically my way of taking space within, you know, spaces in Australia that's touring, and I've engaged a lineup of pure Black Indigenous people of color, and that's through and through music, styling, references. Everything about the night is dedicated to our communities, and so that's a show that's going to be touring around Australia quite a lot. We're doing lots of touring as well through the UK with the Babs. So I'm working with Hannah Conder and Spanky Jackson, who's the current reigning queen, and Hannah's lost with me, so she's a runner-up. So we have a trio called the Babs, and we'll be touring through the UK as well as back in Australia later in the year. So there's lots of cool things happening.
Do you have any plans to head home to Samoa or Tonga anytime soon?
Oh, actually, I have some leave in June. So I was just on the phone with my mum saying, do we go to Bali and have a holiday or do we go to Samoa and not? Like, what do you want to do? So it's still up in the air, depending on what mum wants to do. I would like to go to Samoa this year at some stage just to sort of get my grounding in. But it's definitely on the cards. It's either going to be June or it's going to be Christmas.
Can I ask, have you ever packed any KFC in your luggage to bring back to the islands?
Oh my God, we always pack KFC in the luggage. We always, it's like, oh my goodness, on the plane on the way to Samoa, like growing up, the smell on the plane was always buckets of KFC, like because obviously there isn't one in Samoa. So all the families going there would bring buckets of it. And I will definitely be taking buckets of KFC, regardless of whether it's illegal or not, because my family deserve it.
Oh, Thomas, thank you so much for joining me today from LA. I really appreciate your time.
No, I appreciate you. Thank you, Bobby.
That was Thomas Fonua, also known as Queen Kong. You've been listening to Stories from the Pacific. I'm Bobby McCumber. And to catch more great stories about incredible people from the Pacific, just search for ABC Pacific. And if you'd like to get in touch to tell me about someone you think should be on the show, you can email me at storiesfromthepacific@abc.net.au. This episode of Stories from the Pacific was produced on the lands of the Menang Noongar and also the lands of the Kaurna people.